From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The U.S. Supreme Court in June 2020 voted against the Trump administration's cancellation of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. The 5-4 ruling had a typical liberal to conservative split, with Chief Justice John Roberts casting the deciding vote in joining with the four liberals. The ruling impacts the fate of about 650,000 undocumented immigrants who had obtained a deferment of deportation after meeting stringent criteria and who have been able to work in the U.S. legally. Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote in her opinion that an executive decision to cancel DACA disproportionately harms the same racial group that President Donald Trump branded as less desirable mere months earlier. How the DACA program first came about, what became of the original DREAM Act that it was based on, and what the grassroots movement for dignity was all about is told in a new history book about the so-called Dreamers movement. Its author is Michael A. Olivas, the William B. Bates Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Houston, and author of 16 books, including No Undocumented Child Left Behind, Suing Alma Mater, and more. He joins me to discuss his newest book, Perchance to Dream, a legal and political history of the DREAM Act and DACA. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thank you very much, Sonali. I'm very glad to be here.
So first, let's talk about how this book itself, I understand, is sort of the first comprehensive history of a movement that has been loosely termed the Dreamers. This is not a history that goes back that long, but if we trace its roots, of course, this is a group of people that you describe who've been asking for dignity, for legalization, for a chance to simply live the American dream, if you will, since at least the Obama administration and even before that, right?
Yes, actually, I trace it back, believe it or not, to the 1900s, where we had the very first case of a student not being eligible for in-state tuition in Wisconsin. And it held that the state could make reasonable regulations saying that someone had to live there for at least a year, for example. And most states have adopted this. So early on in the 1960s and 70s, when a few of these students started to surface, mostly in Texas and in California, they made it through public school, and then they presented their college credentials. But it turned out that because their parents had entered the United States illegally or had entered legally and then done something to render themselves out of status, the children were ineligible for in-state tuition. And because in-state is so much cheaper than out-of-state, in Texas, for example, in 1982, in-state tuition was $4 an hour. Out-of-state tuition was 10 times that. So these students were early on trying to get in-state tuition, and that's where I situate the start of this movement.
So this has always been a movement of young people. How have they taken or hold of this idea of the so-called American dream, which, you know, in and of itself is a myth that people have critiqued?
Well, it is. They critique it even more if they're not eligible for it. So I would say it's a dream worth aspiring to. And the United States is an idea and an ideal, and we always fall short of that. But if anybody has helped us come into our own, it is dreamers. These are kids who come with their parents, usually out of status, their parents, that is. And then they grow up in the United States not knowing that they're outsiders or that they live in the shadows, even if their parents have to be more careful and conscientious. Usually when they turn driving age and they have to become eligible for driver's licenses, that's when their parents often tell them that they are not safely in the United States, not permanently, not legally. And that's the come to Jesus meeting that these parents have with their kids.
let's talk about the DREAM Act, which stands for or stood for the Development Relief and Education for Alien Minors. And of course, alien is this horrifically dehumanizing term that the United States applies to people who are immigrants. I myself have been an alien. And it was introduced into the United States Senate all the way back in 2001. So nearly two decades ago. How did that original DREAM Act delineate who was worthy of or deserving of some sort of legalized status?
Well, it's interesting because that is about 20 years ago, but this other movement had gone on with a number of cases that I track in the book for about 20 years before that. So actually, the seeds of this were planted in the 1970s. And then we flash forward after about 15 years after the Immigration Reform and Control Act, President Reagan, that famous liberal, his amnesty, which introduced employer sanctions as well. And so these kids also had been encouraged to stay in school and allowed to stay in school by the important 1982 Supreme Court case, Plyler versus Doe, which said that no state could exclude them from schools, public schools, and they couldn't charge them tuition. Now these kids are beginning to grow up, and you have to ask yourself what happens when Doe goes to college. And so in 2001, the polar opposites, Senator Ted Kennedy, the liberal lion, and his conservative counterpart, Senator Orrin Hatch from Utah, both got together and introduced that bill and said if the students met certain criteria, if they'd been in the United States long enough, if they didn't have major legal actions against them, then they could go through a series of procedures to become permanent residents, a lot like the 1986 Immigration Reform and Control Act had provided for people who were undocumented.
So you have then this idea that these young people who were brought to the United States by their parents and, you know, were so young that they didn't get a choice as to where they were going, deserved to have some path to legalization or at least be allowed to work in the United States. So how did that idea, if you will, gain political traction in Congress?
Well, it gained traction in 1986 sufficient to enable millions of people to legalize and regularize their status, including the parents, who, by the way, in 1982 in the Plyler case, were seen as the transgressors. If the kids are considered innocent, someone's got to be guilty. And so we demonized the parents. And that began to...
And this was the Reagan amnesty that you're referring to, yeah.
Yes. Well, but the actual language of Plyler versus Doe, which is a magnificent case, in my earlier book, No Undocumented Child Left Behind, was about that particular case. That's considered the high water mark for undocumented immigrants in the United States. But if the children are considered innocent, the parents were not. The parents were the transgressors. And so... there was great support. Even Republican polls have shown great deal of satisfaction with and support for, political support for Dreamers, because again, they're considered to be helpless children who came here whose parents are punished. And so by 2001, these kids no longer had a pathway to legalization because for all intents and purposes, IRCA had expired. That is, there was no one else could meet the timelines and so forth. So this was a second attempt, but it was only to help the children, not the parents. The parents had no, they had all aged out of this and they had no traction, no eligibility for it. But even so, it was considered important because at that time, the states began to give in-state tuition to these kids. Texas, for example, was the very first state to do that. And that was also in 2001. But then, of course, 9/11 occurred, and all bets were off the table after that.
Right.
Since that time, neither House nor Senate have both passed it in the same session. And so we are still there, and President Trump is still dithering on this and talking out of both sides of his mouth.
Right. So let's talk about how the DREAM Act turned into this political football in Congress and went back and forth before we get to what then drove Obama to launch the DACA program. How close did the DREAM Act come to actually becoming a bill that could have passed?
One time it came within 5 votes, and each of those votes was heartbreaking. We needed 5 more votes for Republicans and Democrats to vote for it. And Senator McCain, who'd been an enthusiastic supporter, was running for office against President Obama the first time. So he didn't show up. Senator Kennedy was in the hospital for brain cancer, which he died from not long after. Senator Boxer from California had fires in the state. She was unavailable. And Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania said he was for it, but he thought that if it were enacted, it would doom comprehensive immigration reform. And so he bailed on it. So we end up with not by, by one vote shot, well, 5 votes, but all of them insufficient to get it through the Senate, even though the House had done so. And so it would have been signed into law, in my view, during that time, because it was President Bush. Even President Bush bailed on it after 9/11. All bets about international law were really off the table, and any immigration reform that he had been having, especially in discussions with Mexico, were really off the table for the rest of his term.
I want to pick up on what you just said, which is this DREAM Act versus comprehensive immigration reform move. This became a big talking point politically during those years. And it also, I think, reflected some internal divisions within the movement, right? This idea that if you press for legalization or some sort of benefit for one subgroup of undocumented immigrants, it comes at the expense of the bigger group of all immigrants?
Well, yes, although I consider it something of a false premise, because I personally believe, and I think it would be shown, that if we took the easy route first, the kids that nobody believes are troublemakers, and they've just always been leaning into the headwind, but always doing well and acquitting themselves, and a successful program where virtually no one ever fell out of the program due to any transgression at all. If we could get them, then that would have at least gotten them to remove the sword of Damocles hanging over their head. And when they turned 21, they would have been able to petition for their parents in many instances. But now we have neither. And so saying that the subgroup would render the entire group ineligible or unlikely is just nonsensical. I can't prove a negative, but it seems to me that it's demonstrably untrue, because polls are not for the parents, but virtually all the polls have said these kids are favored by the general public.
So let's talk about what happened to the DREAM Act under the Obama administration. Did the reluctance to tackle this under the Bush administration after the 9/11 attacks happened, did that carry over to the Obama administration? This idea that, well, we can't give quote-unquote amnesty, which is how it was cast, to these young immigrants because 9/11?
Well, that's a good way to put it. I'm not sure 9/11 was vocalized as a reason why not. And it still had a great deal of support. And of course, by now, these kids were beginning to accumulate in numbers because they couldn't work, and they all had unlawful presence. And so what happened was that the Obama administration immediately began in its first term, when it had both houses in its favor, and of course they passed other major important bills. First of all, getting the United States back on its feet after the disastrous economic policies before and the war, and the American CARE Act. The so-called Obamacare. So he was riding high, but he sort of ran out of bandwidth. And then he, of course, lost the Senate in the next election. Right. So that he was always trying to justify why we needed to have this. And he began deporting large numbers, in fact, record numbers. It's still, even the Trump administration hasn't deported as many people. So many so that my colleagues and students called him the deporter in chief. I always refused to call him that because I thought what he was trying to do was to show that he was interested in legal immigration. It's just there were no pathways for these kids who Plyler had allowed to stay in school. And so he did some practice runs in Denver and in North Carolina and some other places to see what if we reduced the number of deportations for students. Students had never been a high level. You want to deport people who are either criminals or who had felonies on their record or who had engaged in some terrible misbehavior, which is not these kids. These kids were model kids, more so than, frankly, than U.S. birthright citizens in many instances. And so he proposed DACA, which gave certain number of kids the opportunity to have three different things. The first was a Social Security number. The second was employment authorization. And the third was lawful presence. He also allowed them to leave the United States and come back, which was a derivative benefit. But those three, all ironically, when you flash forward, are often the terms that are used for other kinds of benefits, like to become a lawyer, for example. In a number of states, you have to have a Social Security number. You don't have to have lawful presence, but having lawful presence helps. They didn't have lawful status, but they had lawful presence, which meant that they were not going to be deported without a hearing. And so that was being deferred, and they were allowed to stay here. It sort of washed them, cleansed them of the stigmatizing illegality. And that was simply set aside, and it still is. So these kids rushed into this, and it paid for itself. And by my count, and I've watched this very carefully, fewer than 40 of them have ever been removed from this status because they failed in school, or they got driver's license violations, or they engaged in fraud, or something like that. These are the kids you want your own kids to marry someday. And yet, after it was so successful and it paid for itself, he went a bridge too far. He added what was called DAPA, which would have legalized parents who had U.S. citizen children born in the U.S., even though they were
outside. I want to just interrupt you and go back to the idea of how or what led to Obama thinking that deporting record numbers of people would buy him some sort of political goodwill in Congress from Republicans, because that seemed to be the reason why he did it, this political calculation that I'll give the Republicans something and they will in turn support me. But that didn't happen. That was a miscalculation on his part. And he ended up earning that moniker, Deporter in Chief, which I think he might still be sore about. Only to then end up being the one who signed the executive order for DACA. What was the role that the Dreamer movement played in trying to hold Obama accountable? Did their critique of him as deporter in chief press him to realize that he can't wait for Congress to do this anymore? And he launched DACA that way.
The thing is, it's not something he can do by himself. And in fact, it wasn't an executive order. It was an act of prosecutorial discretion, which is fundamentally different than an executive order.
Thank you for that clarification.
The fact that President Trump misrepresents that doesn't mean that it was so. I think that during that time, there were the so-called marchas, where hundreds of thousands of people marched, including a lot of Dreamers who put themselves at great risk. If they had been arrested, they would have been deported. If they sat in someone's office, as they did with Senator McCain and so forth, they could have been deported. And occasionally some of them were, because it would come to the authorities' attention. But very courageously, they marched. But I think that President Obama, by his sort of dry run that I mentioned in Denver and elsewhere, he'd been trying to do this. He also consulted with a group of immigration law professors, and I'm very proud that I was one of those. I don't say so in the book because there's lots of credit to go around, and of course, even more blame to go around. But he was very thoughtful about it. It's just that you can only do so many things, and while the administration was able to get through some, they saved the country economically, and they put in place health care that the Republicans have tried to remove ever since, he lost part of his backing, and he was no longer veto-proof. And it wasn't just Republicans. There were some conservative Democrats who also had not really been, in my view, sufficiently woke to do this. And there were some Republicans, on the other hand, as with Senator Hatch, who were for the kids, although he never ended up voting for the Dream Act when it actually came, when it came up for votes. So the support was always lukewarm, and it would depend on how the story was told and the like. I had taken bets, though, that with the two of them having introduced it, and with the Democrats holding all three houses, that it would have occurred in his first term. I was saddened, and I've been bereft ever since, that that didn't occur. And so at that time, in 2012, his second term is when DACA comes about. And I think it was this frustration. And he went as far as he could because he didn't have the executive authority to legalize these kids. He could do things that were discretionary, like not make them a subject of deportation or give them a blanket authorization to work and social security numbers, which, by the way, was something most of them wanted because they've been working off the books. And this allowed them to come out and take real jobs since that time. So I think he played it as he played the game of the hand of cards as well as he was dealt.
Right.
And had he had things gone better the first time, if it hadn't been Senator Kennedy not being able to vote, almost in and of itself dooms it because he was so obviously for it. And each of them had a good reason not to. I wish that they could have voted, you know, from California or from his bed or whatever, but it just wasn't to be. But it was close, and we were all emboldened at that time that we lost the Senate, and it's never surfaced since, except in the House. The House has a version, the Promise Act, that has passed, but the Senator McConnell has just never taken it up. And also the matter was challenged at that time when Justice Scalia died. A case had been moving forward on the constitutionality of the entire program, and it tied 4-4, which sent it back to the Fifth Circuit and back to a Texas judge, and that was frozen. Now, as you know, Senator McConnell did not allow Judge Garland to have a decent hearing at that time.
This was Obama's whatsoever. Pick for the Supreme Court.
Yes. Yeah, and so any one of those things would have been enough to doom it, and all of them occurring at once. Had there been a fifth vote, had there been, no fire in California, had it been someone else other than McCain the first time, et cetera, all of those things just doomed it. And it, you know, for want of a nail, the kingdom is lost. It's just the way that it goes. But the pathways are very clear, and it would have been wonderful. And I think today it still could be enacted. The only good thing to come from this recent case where the Trump administration could have shut it down. I would concede they could have. It's just that they're the gang that can't shoot straight. Just like the census case, they decided not to follow the rules. And as you've said in your introduction, the 5-4 decision went against them. All that
right,
does
because
is
the Supreme
time.
Court judged and ruled based on sort of them not following the technical, proper rules to do what they wanted to do rather than the merits of the case. Yeah.
Well, that's true. The merits of the case are still at issue in the U.S. v. Texas case that has been sidelined while all of this DACA rescission matter came forward. So Judge Hayden has taken the case again, and I'm assuming that it's going to move forward. Although, as the president said in Telemundo the other day, maybe because he's being interviewed in Spanish, he didn't know what he was saying. He says, "I'm going to sign an executive order. We're going to take care of these dreamers because they're great people." Well, before he said that they aren't all angels, I'm deferring to his judgment on that. He would know. He's talked out of both sides of his mouth. And he has signaled to the Republicans heading the Senate that he doesn't want to do it right now. And so I think they're going to sit on it while he tries to whittle away at it. And he's hoping we just aren't watching, but we are. I'm on the board of the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund, and this is our case. We've taken this case. We're one of a number of groups, and we're interveners in it, and we are parties to the previous case. It's still sitting on the sidelines. And we are strategizing. Different groups are sending forward applications. And the administration has run out of money because Department of Human Services, of Homeland Security, in particular, runs on fees, and because they simply shut down all transactions, such as new DACA members or people filing for asylum and so forth, they've run out of money, and they're going to probably end up furloughing workers in August. Again, this is just so cataclysmically bad and so poorly administered and so clueless, but I think it's on purpose. They're doing the opposite of whistling on the way to the bank. They are ruining these programs on the way to the bank. And it is just very dispiriting to try and preach the rule of law when the administration's gotten caught twice in lying and misrepresenting facts, as they did in the census case.
Well, Michael, there's much more to talk about, and certainly our audience can read your book directly to get more of that history you've written about. Thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you very much, Sonali. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Michael A. Olivas, the William B. Bates Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Houston. He's written 16 books, including No Undocumented Child Left Behind. We've been talking about his newest book, Perchance to Dream, A Legal and Political History of the Dream Act and DACA. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.